Okay, this is Julie Pearson, Little Thunder. Today's December 1st, and I'm interviewing Bert Seaburn for the Oklahoma Native Artist Project, sponsored by the Oklahoma Oral Histories Research Project at OSU. We're in Bert's home in Oklahoma City, and Bert, you have such a range of subject matter and formats, but your style is always instantly recognizable as yours. Where were you born, and where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in a little town called Red Barn, Texas, but I was born in, had a midwife come out the house. I lived on the banks of the Pecos River, and then I think the next day they took me into the closest big town, which is Ira Ann, Texas, and that's on my birth certificate then.
What did your mom and dad do for a living?
My dad, when we were in Texas, he worked for Humble Oil Company, a refinery, and my mother didn't work. From there, I was in the sixth grade, we moved to Arkansas for a couple of years, and my dad decided to go to California work in the shipyards. So he dropped us off in Purcell, Oklahoma, which my mother had lived in her early years. And so he went on to California and stayed there.
Did your mom have, were her parents still around? Were they in Purcell?
No, her father died many years ago, but her mother died while I was in the Navy. I was stationed in San Diego at the time, and she died in, I think, 1952.
I see. And any brothers or sisters?
I have a brother and a half-brother, and they're both deceased.
You know, all families have stories about who they are and where they came from. What are some stories that your family told?
Gee, I don't know of any stories. It is, I guess, just a struggle to make a living. And
on your dad's side, did you have contact with your grandparents at all? Or
no, we were... In fact, I call my grandfather Mr. Seaborn, you know, that's that far away from him.
Wow.
So we'd see him about once a year. We lived in Texas, and they lived in Cisco, Eastland, Texas. But we only got to see each other maybe once a year or something like that.
Right. Like Ben Harjo, cartoons were one of your early loves. How young were you when you first became interested in cartoons?
Well, I started wanting to be an artist, a cartoonist, when I was 5 years old. And I kept that desire up then on up through high school. But I enjoyed, you know, comic books, things like that. And I could envision me doing a super colossal flying Red Zenith or something, you know.
Well, and you actually sold a cartoon, right?
I did. I sold a cartoon, King Feature Syndicate, when I was in the eighth grade at Purcell, Oklahoma. And it was published in a comic book, and I think I was paid $5 for it, which wasn't bad at that time.
That was pretty good money for a kid in eighth grade.
And then I went 5 years before I sold my second cartoon. And then I was in the Navy, and I used to sell a lot of cartoons while I was in the Navy. I'd have cartoons going back and forth, publishers of magazines, things like that, plus local publications. And so I really was doing a lot of cartoon work then.
I know you didn't have art classes in high school, but did you have any art experiences at the elementary school level?
You know, no art classes. I guess the closest thing to an artist I knew was a sign painter. And I'd watch him paint for hours, you know.
Is that right?
Yeah, but no. I guess when I was in high school, I would hitchhike up to Oklahoma City, either that or catch a freight train there in Purcell, right up to Oklahoma City to the art center. And so I saw art every month. But it's all just hitchhiking up and back, you know. Growing up, we didn't have any any paintings in the house, no books, no nothing, except my comic books. And so the only time I could ever see a painting was maybe at the Oklahoma Arts Center, and then I had to work to get up there to see that.
How did you get your, did you have to work to get your comic books, or?
I managed to get them some way. I don't.
Yeah.
At one time I had first issues of all the comic books, and then Superman, everybody else, and then when I went to the Navy, they all got destroyed.
Oh. I was curious too if your folks were supportive of your drawing, your love of cartoons, and your, was your mom, was she aware of the fact that you love to draw cartoons, or?
I don't think my mother was aware of anything concerning me. I did my own thing. And
did you have any exposure to Indian art during that period?
Not growing up, no. When I, after the Navy, I went in, I was OCU, and I was doing non-objective abstracts then.
As you were taking classes there? Mm-hmm. Or had you kind of already developed an abstract style?
Well,
painting on
probably
your own?
A little of both.
Okay.
But I had a friend out there, Bill Flores, and Bill worked at Tinker Air Force Base doing artwork there, and I worked at OG&E doing artwork. So we had shows together, and he's actually the one that convinced me to start showing in a All Indian Mall show. So without, if it hadn't been for Bill, I probably wouldn't have ever pursued my Indian heritage that way.
Now, Bill, so you met at OCU? You met Bill at OCU? Is that what you were
right,
saying?
Right.
Okay. Was he taking classes too?
Yeah, he was taking night classes as
gotcha.
Well.
Gotcha.
We worked during the day and taking night classes at night.
Uh-huh. Right, right. So you kind of became interested in your Cherokee heritage, more interested in college, you said.
Yeah.
Was it mainly through Bill, or was it also just through encountering other students or what you were studying, or?
Well, we'd have assignments in class,
mm-hmm.
to do maybe still life, something like that, but then on our own we could paint anything we wanted to. So that's when I would do my Indian things.
Right, right. And that's great, that wasn't discouraged, because for some artists, you know, taking classes, it was discouraged during that time.
Yeah, and during that time, during the little mall shows, Fred Beaver and Rance Hood, Kelly Haney, you know, you could buy any of our works for $5, you know, at that time.
What was the public, what was the reception of the works like? Were people pretty interested at that point in Indian art?
So, you know, I might sell it as much as $5 worth a whole weekend, you know,
right.
at a mall show.
Right, right.
So that's how interested people were.
What was it like just kind of chatting with Fred Beaver and Rance Hood? Did you mention him as being one of them?
Yeah, Fred Beaver and good show I had was with Fred. We had a two-person show at the Heard Museum in Scottsdale, or Phoenix. And, that was way back in the, I guess, late 60s or early 70s, something like that. And then they bought some for their permanent collection. But that was a good experience. Fred and I were good friends for many years.
Did you ever enter any of the Philbrook annual shows?
Pardon me?
Did you ever enter any of the Philbrook annual
shows? Oh, yes. Yeah, I have won awards there at Philbrook at their annual Indian show. And it's been a long time ago, but I did enter a show, sure.
Right.
Black Bear Bosun, a lot of those well-known people were showing at that time.
Right, that was an exciting time, and I just found out about the Reject Room not too long ago. Do you remember that?
The what?
The Reject Room at the Philbrook Annual.
Oh, no.
And that was where they would hang paintings that didn't make it into the jury section.
I didn't know they had one. I'm sure I hadn't put many in there.
Oh, I don't know. Well, so during the Navy, you really were, I think, a public information officer, is that right?
Yes, This was when I was in VR-8 at Hickam Air Force Base, the Navy Squadron. And we did training and safety brochures, evacuation illustrations, how to get on and off a plane, and how to put on a Mae West. Then I was the art director for the little magazine they had, monthly magazine. I did covers, illustrations inside for that. And then from there, I was there 2 years, and from there I went over to Pearl Harbor. And I was the artist for us at Sink Pack Fleet. And it was a big operation. They had, we had one large building where they had nothing but journalists, writers, photographers, and there were two artists, myself and one other person. And we did work for all the ships at sea. If they didn't have anyone, they could request what they wanted. We'd do work for them. We had one feature called Little Known Facts About Your Navy, which is like Believe It or Not. Another one, Navy Heroes, Little Known Facts About Your Navy, and then Navy Cartoons. And these were published, during that time they didn't have offset printing, everything was letterpress. So we'd do the artwork there in at Pearl Harbor, ship the work up to Great Lakes, they would make mats from those. And then we had a mailing list of 1,500 weekly newspapers that used our work. And that kept the Navy name out front in case someone was wanting to join something. If they saw Navy enough, maybe they'd join the Navy. So these were supplied free of charge. And great experience for me.
I was going to say, because you're drawing all kinds of poses, et cetera, just some really good training.
And in addition to that, my work had been published in All Hands, Navy Aviation News, and
right.
Different magazine cartoons. I'd submit cartoons for those. And so, I worked freelance downtown with a magazine. I did one publication. They did about 30 cartoons a month for me in their magazine in downtown Honolulu.
Wow.
So I had a lot of cartoons going at that time. And I was submitting cartoons to magazines here in the States also, selling that way.
Right. So was your initial thought that you would come back, when you came back to civilian life, you would maybe be a commercial artist?
How about a cartoonist?
Or a cartoonist.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I had my own little syndicate for a while, weekly newspapers. I'd have one cartoon each.
Oh, wow.
Little local newspapers, Yukon Review, El Reno, Mustang, but I was working as at OG&E.
Have you saved all those cartoons together?
I used to have them.
Would be an interesting.
I found one the other day, an old Navy cartoon that was published probably about in 1953, something like that. And it showed a sailor, he's in a doctor's office. And he had tattoos on his chest. He had a map, South Pacific. And he was telling the doctor, said, yeah, doc, said the pain's somewhere between Quadge and Aniwetok, you know.
That's neat.
Well, at OG&E, I went to work, Simcoe Color Press, I started out with them, 50 cents an hour, but I could work as many hours as I wanted to. And I kept it up for a couple of weeks, then I went to work for Oklahoma Gas Electric Company as a draftsman. And I was doing about 50% drawing, posters, bulletin board posters. I worked with a magazine there. And then the other half was engineering drawings. And then I got a Simcoe Color Press offered me a full-time art director job. So I turned in my resignation at OG&E. And then the last day of my 2 weeks' notice, OG&E said, well, if you'll stay here, we'll create an art department here for you. I said, okay, I'll stay. So I went in and stayed there 23 years then, doing magazine, newspaper advertising, brochures, billboard layouts, whatever, magazine, art director. And during that time, that's when I went to night school at OCU.
Then you were also painting on the side, I guess, possibly.
Well, really, I wasn't doing too much painting then. I first started out, I wanted to be an illustrator, just a commercial artist. And then at OCU, well, most all the art courses were geared to fine arts. So after a while, I decided that's where I wanted to go then. And then I would spend weekends, nights, little model shows, painting, whatever. I used to enter the Scottsdale Annual, which was at that time, the biggest Indian art show, I guess, in the world. I think they had several categories. I was there about five or six paintings in each category. And my paintings were in like $5, $10, something like that. Fritz Schoeller, his was like 15. He was in the shows, too.
I think I remember reading that when you started doing, you know, Indian images, that you, because there wasn't a market for those images, that
right,
you sort
yeah.
of suffered uh-huh. a little bit financially because you were having to sell your paintings so much less.
And my mother, she used to tell stories about Indian fables, stories involving Indian people, and I thought, well, it'd be nice just to start doing something like that. So that's what I really started. When I first started painting, for about the first 2 years, I did very stylized, linear, outline, Indian-style painting.
Oh, kind of the flat style?
Yeah.
More uh-huh. than that. Okay.
And I did that about 2 years.
I see.
And then I decided that wasn't for me. I needed to, I liked what I was doing, but I wanted to do my own version or different.
Right.
A little more abstract, a little more something about it. And I came up with a bird of prey type thing with maybe a grandfather image superimposed somewhere within the painting. And it caught on, and that was the type reason I had to show at the Herd that early in my career.
What year was that?
Well, it was either late 60s or early 70s. But then, and I was the only one doing that at that time, then it spread like wildfire. That's what people thought Indian art was then, with a bird of prey. And
right, the portraits and the...
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's kind of an archetypal image. You know, some people interpret it like as a medicine person or a shaman, I think you've sometimes referred to it, or a storyteller.
Well, of course, throughout Indian history, you know, they've always been involved with animals, birds, things like that, talking to them,
right.
Guidance, different things, you know. So I just made a good story type. I could create my own, I could do reference work and find things related to it.
Right.
And so it's just so much to work with that I just really enjoyed all of it, you know.
The researching, the painting. Helper figures, sort of. You sort of saw them that way from the beginning.
Sure, yes. Many clans are named after the different animals, things like that. So it's only natural that you can work out a nice subject type thing.
Right, right.
And that lasted about 21 years.
Wow, that you really focused more on portraits, you're saying, with the animal figures or
well,
figures.
With people, say.
Okay. And yeah, because sometimes they were full figure, I think.
Yeah, but nothing, no portrait type thing, just a
right.
A grandfather
right, figurative.
Image, we'll call
yes.
it, a shaman
right.
image.
Right. I read that when you it was first of all kind of a, it was a move that you sort of tried to prepare for in terms of shifting when you finally decided I want to do this fine art thing full time. I want to, you know,
right.
leave my job and do this. So how did you negotiate that? That's a big...
Well, in my work at OG&E, I could split my vacations up. I could take for shows, things like that. I would take a week off here and week off there. But then I had a good opportunity to go to Germany 1 year to do paintings and talks about Native American art. And I'd already used up my vacation, so I couldn't get off. So I started thinking then, I need to get away from here. And I spent after about 22 years there at OG&E, well, I talked to Bonnie, my wife, about leaving, and she said, well, we need another refrigerator. Let's wait next year. We'll talk about it. So next year, the old car is about ready to fall apart. Let's wait to get another car. And finally, after about the third year, well, I said, I got to get away. So we gave up all the good fringe benefits and hospitalization and quit, and I started painting 24 hours a day.
I was going to say, because one of the statements I ran across said you were putting out around 365 paintings a year. That's a lot of work.
I kept that up for about 21 years also. I might skip a day or two, but then I'd make up for it.
Right, right.
Maybe traveling from here to California, I wouldn't have time to paint, but when I got up there, I got back, then I'd paint maybe 8 or 10, you know. So.
That's a tremendous amount of work.
At that time, they were all numbered on the back. So I had a little code that told me the day, the month, the number of the painting for that series.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Did Bonnie take on some of the business aspects too once you made that shift?
Did she what?
Did she take on some of the business?
Oh, she did all the business.
Jobs, okay.
I'm not smart. And so she took care of all the book work and go to the framers, pick out frames, pick out mats. She became quite a authority on art, a very good art critic.
Yeah, sometimes that's the most important feedback, isn't it?
It is, yes. And she didn't mind telling me if there's something wrong with the painting either.
I think it's interesting that you showed both at the Red Earth Indian Arts Festival in 67 when it opened, and also at the Oklahoma City Arts Festival when it opened, and then of course you were at both shows for a lot of years. How were those two shows important to you?
Well, it gave me an outlet to sell. You know, that's, I guess that's the whole thing.
And well publicized venue.
Yeah. Red Earth, the first show they had, I was the poster artist that year.
Oh.
So I used one of my paintings for the poster. And then from then on, it was usually the best of show got their work published. But the first year, they didn't have anybody, so they picked me, which is good.
Yeah.
And but it gave me a chance to get exposure, same way as the Festival of the Arts downtown. You know, a lot of people at the Festival of the Arts, it was a earlier than the Red Earth, of course. There for a year or two, my most expensive painting was maybe $15. And I would go down there and I'd have like 100, 150 original paintings I sold for 50 cents each.
Wow.
And I know there's one dentist from Duncan, he came up and he'd buy 50 at a time. And then he'd give them to his patients, you know, his little gifts.
Right.
But they were nice little original paintings. And next year I raised them to $1. And then the year after that, I think it went up to $5. And
so when you began painting for a living, did you have to rethink your pricing again? I mean, and I realize there were years in between.
Well, by that time, the paintings were up to where I could make a living painting.
Okay.
I had, for 20-something years, I did about 13 major shows a year. And these were from Port Jefferson, New York, to about 3 or 4 galleries in California. Santa Fe, Taos, Albuquerque, all in between, a lot of Indian, Gallup. We had like 13 major shows a year for about 20 years. Sometimes we'd maybe fly in from New York, change clothes, take a bath, get in the car, and take off for California then.
That's a very heavy show schedule.
It was a mad area, but we both enjoyed it. We were young, and we could do it then.
Right.
And well, then in addition to that, I had, during those years, I had shows in, say, 2 shows in Germany. Had one in Singapore, Taiwan, England, Then I was in a traveling show in South America, showed at the embassies in each country there. So we worked those in, and I was traveling Europe as well as local.
I know, that's just a wonderful opportunity. How did that impact your style, do you think, or maybe your philosophy of art, or just...
A couple of things. When I went to France, there were five artists went. Ben Harjo was one of those. And then we had about 50 patrons of ours that went with us. So if they were from Oklahoma and Arkansas both, and Stu Shirley Wells at Indian Art Gallery in Sepulpa. But then I, in addition to my Indian work, I started doing ladies in the fast lane. And they had real kissy lips type things. And I tried that for a couple of years, but I couldn't sell enough to make a living, so I had to drop that. Then when I went to Taipei and Singapore both, I guess, I think it was their $20 bill had a kingfisher on it. And they did a lot of birds thing, but no, not too many birds of prey. So I came back while I was getting older, more mellow, and so I pretty much phased out my bird, my fighting bird, birds of prey, and just I do other kind of, you know, mockingbirds, whatever. And so I did that for a long time then.
Did you look at very much Chinese art while you were there? Did you have that?
As much as I could,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, every place I go, I look as much art as I can.
Right, right.
And I taught over there when I was in Singapore. I taught every night. OCU sponsored the trip. And the first night, they wanted to kind of publicize the little, I'd be up there working in a big ballroom. And we had maybe 20, 25 people there watching. Next night, we had about 150. Next night, about between 300 and 500 people, they couldn't even get in.
My goodness.
And
word of mouth, it got out, didn't it?
And one thing kind of different, the newspaper, well, Kelly Haney and I, we were together showing. And I had Red Indians, like headlines, you know.
Oh.
And I'd never seen that before. But India being so close there to Singapore, they have their Indians there.
Right.
So distinguished, they call American Indian Red Indian. And
Did you do any sculpting at OCU?
No. I did some pottery type things, you know.
Right.
But no sculpting.
So when you got the commission to do the bronze sculpture in 86 for Southwestern Bell, how did you go about?
Well, I wanted to incorporate the Medicine Man grandfather image in with my red tail hawk. We see more of those than we do eagles around here.
Right.
So I did a red tail hawk, and I didn't want to do the typical buildup of wax. So I used sheets of balsa wood and constructed that with each. A little different from anything around.
Right.
And, but came up with this, I don't know, I made about five or six models before I ever turned one in, and about 100 drawings.
Wow.
But I finished this one and then had it cast here in Oklahoma City, at that time, Scissortail Foundry. Then there is one of the five finalists in the deal, and then I got the commission from that.
I see.
But I never did, that's my only sculpting.
That you've done since.
But I felt honored. All the other four were professional sculptors, you know.
Right.
And Charlie Pratt was one of the five.
I see, yeah.
And
stiff competition. Well, you've worked in a variety of media, acrylics, watercolor. I saw some monotypes and acrylic collages. Does the effect that you're going after is that what determines what medium you use, or does it sometimes depend on your mood or on your subject?
No, not really. It's just a phase I went through. I started out with oil paints, did oils for several years, and from there went to watercolor. Did watercolor for 20 years, and then I wanted to start doing more canvas pieces. So I switched to acrylic then.
Right.
And so I'm working 99% acrylics now. And still love it. I've been with it several years. I'm still learning, but and I teach 2 nights a week at City Arts, acrylic painting classes there. And I've been out there quite a while too. But I enjoy teaching. I didn't think I would, but I do.
Yeah, it's funny how that works out, isn't it? What about your, can you talk about your acrylic collages a little bit? What gave you the idea to kind of combine painting, more traditional acrylic painting, with collage?
Of course, in abstract, you always pick up a piece of paper or cloth or bottle caps or something, you know. As an artist, you're doing that, picking up all kinds of junk. And you need a place to put it sometimes, so with the words on it, I guess when I made a show in France, I did this painting. I had this little American girl. She had a little French hat on and kind of a little sassy look about her, and along the side there, she was in American in Paris, we'll say. And she says, I want to order French fries, French toast, and a French kiss, please.
Yeah, I love, you know, there's always, when you combine the text with the paintings, most of the ones that I saw, there's a humor to them, but it's a humor with an edge, like you're almost trying to get people to sort of look at some behavior that they're engaged in.
Well, sometimes, you know, I have a good title, and rather than put the title on the back, I'll just put it on the front, you know.
I see. Make it part of the text.
Sure. There's nothing new. You know, it's been done.
Right.
Picasso, you know, he did names on some of his paintings. And so it's nothing really new, just different words.
Right. Having fun with that. Well, you know, your work is not only eclectic, it's just very, in some ways, it's really erudite, I think. And, you know, I was interested to see that the Egon Schiele, the painting that you had, the kind of cited Schiele's work, or I saw another one where you referred to de Kooning. And so do you research art history a little bit for ideas sometimes too, or is that the impact of your travels, or?
I guess all of it combined, you know. I go into a doctor's office or anything. I never read a book. I look at pictures. I mean, I can go through 20 books pretty fast. And, but then every once in a while you'll find, you know, I mean, look through 20 books and you find something. That'd make a good painting, you know. So jot down a note or two, you know. And then everyday life, just like when I was cartooning, different things would come up during the day, you'd write down. And same with the titles of paintings. When I'm driving, that's probably my most creative time. And I always have a notepad there, and I'll tell Bonnie to write this down. Or else if she's asleep, I'll write it down. But you're just sitting there driving, nothing to do except watch, and you have all these thoughts coming around. So
It'll be both titles and images, or?
Pardon?
Will your ideas that you get while you're driving be both titles and images?
Both, yeah. Mm-hmm. I can see a whole painting, you know. And if I don't write it down, though, I'll forget.
Right. And, Do you think there's any Fritz Sometimes I sense a little bit of Fritz Scholder influence. I don't know why. Did you?
Well,
were you interested in his work at one
point? Sure. I think I've been influenced by every artist I've ever met, one way or the other. And I knew Fritz. We've had dinner with him in his home in Scottsdale, him and his first wife. And we've competed for 20 years or so in shows and galleries. But we were friends, and sure. In fact, in addition to maybe being influenced by him, I've been influenced by the person that influenced Scholder, Nathan Oliveira. And but we've both been influenced by Nathan, a San Francisco artist. The single, solitary Indian standing, you know, and but that's very typical of what Oliveira did.
I see. One of the images that I kind of like in your more, I think it's in your more recent work, but it's a kind of dark-haired woman and dark, she kind of looks dark-skinned or she's in darker tones, and she's got her hair, it's either on top of her head or it's kind of this triangular cut.
Well, I don't remember her.
I'll have to show you in your catalog. In fact, I think I saw her, well, it, up here, for example, in the corner.
Oh, yeah, well.
So I guess it's just a, an image with, you know, the hair is generally the same, but yeah, it's kind of an intriguing, but you're not thinking of anybody in particular.
No,
you didn't have a model.
I'm just trying to get something that...
that looks pleasing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think that's...
No, I do a lot of ballerinas, a lot of, and they may wind up looking something alike, but...
Uh-huh.
Grandmas, whatever, you know, I do a lot of paintings.
Uh-huh. Well, it's just a particular look, you know, sometimes it's a portrait, sometimes it's a full-length painting, but I really like your, the motif of the music in some of your paintings, combined with this very...
Well, let me tell you about that.
Swatches of color, tell me about that.
I've never really been, I always painted the country western music, when I painted, and then after our grandchildren got up in high school, we had two violinists and a cellist. And so I was forced to listen to classical music then, and I loved it. So I painted for a number of years just classical music. I don't know what anything about it except I like the sound, you know, I guess.
And when I walked in, that's what was playing.
And so our grandson was a cellist. And I started painting a lot of cello playing people, and a few violinists. And but that, I guess that was my reason I've come out. You know, I still do. I still put music notes or something in a lot of my abstracts. It may not mean anything to anybody, but I've done a lot with...
Well, you had the cover art for the Mozart Festival, I noticed. And that wasn't music, actually, which would have been appropriate. It was flowers, as I remember, but...
Uh-huh. Yeah. In fact, I painted a violin for them. You know.
Oh, did you? Okay,
yeah.
That was another...
And it was auctioned off. It was, it had a nice abstract on it.
Oh, wow.
And we had a show up there, the gallery, our gallery at 50 Penn Place had a show up there during that.
That's neat. Humor is like a big part of your work. Why is it so important to you? Sometimes it's just in the title, sometimes it's in the subject matter. And obviously part of it lies in your love of cartoons, I guess. But
why is it important? Well, sometimes it's not important when I'm thinking about it. And then maybe after I've painted it, it's something that I think, I don't think I can ever do this, create this again, you know. So that therefore it becomes, I guess, very personable and something that I hate to get rid of. And Route 66, that's always been a favorite.
Yeah.
I don't even show that anymore. I'm scared someone will buy it.
Right. not for sale on there.
But once in a while, and Bonnie, she's if I have a painting that she likes, she gets to pick it, keep it for her insurance, I guess.
That's great.
And so she's picked out a few. One time, she picked out a painting, and we had a couple of people from Dallas up here one evening. And they stayed and stayed, and Bonnie going to bed. So they wanted to buy the ones that Bonnie had picked for herself. So I went in and woke Bonnie up, and she really went away. She said, "Do what you want to, you know." So I sold it. And the next day she found out what had happened. She's very, very upset. And so then about 2 years later, this guy called me from Texas. He knew that Bonnie had been upset. About 2 years later, he called and said, "Well," I said, "I'm filing bankruptcy." He said, "Would you like to buy that painting back? Same price I paid for it." And I said, "Yes." So I bought it back for Bonnie. And
that's wonderful. And it's fairly, I think a lot of artists' wives feel that way. And it's wonderful to get the opportunity to buy it back. What is your creative process?
I don't really have a necessarily creative process. I enjoy working in my sketchbooks. And a lot of times, when I first get to the studio morning, I may do two or three little quick sketches, something like that. Nothing else, just limbering up, finishing a cup of coffee maybe, but just start painting, and then it'll kind of develop as I go. You know, I know basically maybe I want a warrior holding a shield, maybe three feathers coming down, breastplate, something like that. Then I'll start sketching and maybe make changes, you know, turn upside down, start again. And but just, I guess, just experimenting with my, I know basically what I want. I know I want an Indian with this or that or that. And then trying to get it to look like something that other people's going to like. You got to keep that in mind too. And so you're not just pleasing yourself, I guess you're pleasing everybody.
Right.
But you do need to please yourself first. And if you can't please yourself, then it's hard to sell it to somebody else. I have let some get out, I guess, that I wasn't 100% sure of, but most usually it's something I really like.
That's great.
I have a lady, I was working at the gallery yesterday, and a lady came in, and she looked all around, and finally she said, "I'm looking for a Tahlequah Potter." I said, "And friend." She said, "Yeah." And it's one I did several years ago, and it shows this potter and holding a pot, and then it's another little drawing down there of a dog. It looks like it's been collaged on, but it's actually just painted right on there. And then up by the face, by the feather of the Tahlequah Potter, it says Tahlequah Potter, and then by the little dog, it says "And friend." So, and it's probably, 8-10 years old at least, and but I still have it.
But you still have it.
Yeah, I'm taking it to the gallery today, actually, and she's going to come pick it up.
That's great. Well, tell me a little bit about the gallery. It's a co-op. Actually, there's two co-op galleries you're involved with.
Yeah, well, about 18...
Can you explain 18, how they work?
Pardon?
Can you start maybe by explaining how they work?
It started out about 17, 18 years ago. This gallery was getting started, 50 Penn Place, and it was going to be a co-op gallery. And they called one if I'd like to be in on it. I said, "Sure." So most of there's only three of us still with it from the early days. But we have 13 working members, and we all equal owners of it. And then we have guest artists that we can let people show. and we charge a small fee. We pay a fee ourselves, and we charge a small fee for the guest artist, but that's what we pay our rent with.
And so each month you pay?
Yes, we don't make any money. All we do is pay our bills and pay her for advertising shows, things like that. That gives us a place to show, and we take turns working. We work alphabetical order, and if somebody, like our daughter Connie, if it comes to her time to work during the week, then she'll trade with someone for a weekend, so she can work weekend and not have to work during the week. So it's very flexible that way. We trade out days, and but we had that for like 18 years, I guess, and then we had the opportunity to start another gallery at North Park Mall, and so we went up there, and they had two spots available. We looked at both of them and decided to one, and we told them we'd try it out for a couple months, and we repainted everything, floor, walls, got everything ready, and we've been in now one month, and we just opened November the 1st. And there's, I think, 10 of us up there. And we take turns working. It's open 6 days a week. And it's basically the same as the other, except we don't have guest artists. What we do, we split the bills, and we pay all our bills that way, just split it, whatever it costs. And then we all had to ante up money for the start, for the opening day,
right?
Have a little bit of money in the cash register,
right?
And but it's a nice little gallery, and that's basically what it is, just a group of artists get together, they want a place to show, and maybe for a little extra income, or help with the rent, they invite guest artists to come in, but it gives them a place to show too, because a lot of artists are looking for places to show.
Venues, that's right. That's right.
And, but it's a nice little deal. We don't make much money, but it sure helps.
Right. And it's a switch. I think every artist sometimes is ready.
And it's not on a national scale, you know, it's just Oklahoma City.
Right.
And vicinity.
Right.
I guess. And we send out we do have a web page. But we send out, I think, 1,800 invitations each time we have a show. We have a show every other month, the second Friday of every other month. And opening receptions, it's almost elbow to elbow people. We get good response. We have a lot of people come in. And they may not come again for next opening, but a lot of good patrons that follow what we do, and then newcomers coming in, and so it's just a good experience.
Yeah, I think those are a great idea for artists. The passage of the Indian Arts and Crafts Act in 1990 kind of changed the Indian art gallery scene for artists who couldn't provide proof of Indian identity, and I know here in Oklahoma a lot of gallery owners remain loyal to their artists, because there was always a group of artists that were not enrolled. But I'm just kind of wondering how that sort of impact, if you remember those days and you sort of remember what happened at that point.
I remember quite well those days. I was probably the oldest one affected at that time.
Willard Stone
had just died, maybe. So I made headlines from New York to California to France. You know, ever since I was in high school, I'd been thought of as an Indian. Coach, give the ball to the Indian, you know.
Right, the teasing and all the stuff that.
Yeah, and we had disconnect our phones. We had phone calls coming in from all over the world want to talk to us about it. Bonnie couldn't take it, and we'd go to a psychologist, psychiatrist for her. I did a series of cartoons, or not cartoon, but it was birds talking, and it was about the Indian law. I couldn't sleep. I got up one night and I did these sketches all night long. I made etching plates the next day, and I did 10, actually 10 etchings, and only 9 of them I used. And I had been a tribal council at one time during that period, something like that, had voted me to be a Indian artist. Not a card carrying, but just a...
Right, just certified by the tribe.
And about a week later, Wilma changed her mind and said no.
Wilma Mankiller, this is.
Uh-huh. And so I have a little deal, something like that. You will be Indian until the waters quit flowing and to this or that, or until I change my mind. And I have a letter from at that time, I think Wilma's chief, but I have a letter saying that I don't remember what it says, but in general it says you're recognized as an Indian artist, and Red Earth, you had to get something after that to be able to show. So the tribal council or someone sent me a letter. I requested it. They sent a letter and stating that I could show.
Right.
And I quit showing anyway. Bonnie, I would love to go ahead and show. I think I'm entitled to it.
Right.
But Bonnie didn't want me to show. I'd still, you know.
In Indian art shows anymore? You mean?
Huh?
You mean? At Indian art shows these
days? Yeah, she didn't even want me to show at the master show at Muskogee, but I do.
Yeah.
And, but I don't show at the Red Earth because she didn't want me to.
Mm-hmm.
And I do very little. I painted Indians. Probably 75% of my paintings are Indian related, and I love it. I have a disclosure I put on the back of them.
Mm-hmm.
Something like, if you're buying this painting because you think I'm an Indian, stop. Because the Indian law 1990. But I'll say, if you're buying because this you like this piece of art, then go for it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
so in a way, the art was the way of dealing with the disruption of your life and the pain and everything else. Did you kind of just channel it into your artwork again? I mean, the cartoons, those were good ways of, you know.
I don't think I ever did it. I just did that one series of etchings.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding that issue, and I did one other painting one time. I did this Indian face, and then like the circle with the line through it. Disabled people parking, they got a...
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, I gotcha.
You know what I mean? Something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's like no access,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, I did
yes.
This one Indian face, and I put that slash, circle slash on that.
Yeah.
And but I didn't really show it. I still have it in the attic.
Right.
But no, I let it go. I just try not to let it bother me.
Right.
I paint what I want to. I just don't say I'm Indian.
Right.
$100 million, you know, if you say you're an Indian and you're not. So I just say, hey, I'm undocumented. If they ask, I say, I'm
right.
Undocumented. I'm not,
right.
I'm not a member of any tribe. And undocumented. And, but I can paint anything I want to.
Right, right. Good for you. I know that one of your daughters, Connie, chose to be an artist. You have 3 daughters, and you know, worked professionally for quite a while in the arts. I understand she's teaching now and doing her art. Mm-hmm. But I just wondered, did you ever give her any professional advice?
Well, when she was young, I would try. I was teaching then to night YMCA type, YW, and I would. She'd wind up crying. I didn't know how to. I wouldn't know how to tell her to do something without hurting her feelings. You know.
It's hard, parent child teaching.
So
I think
we had trouble that way, and then she got married, then the divorce, come back home and live for a while, and then by that time she had matured, I had matured, and she took some lessons with me again, and we worked fine then.
That's great.
And even today, some of my students, I think they get, I'll tell them what to do, and they'll say, but I like it this way. I say, okay, do it that way, you know. That's fine. You don't have to do it like I do. Teachers walk a thin line.
Right, exactly. It's not unusual for, you know, artists to trade work, or, you know, when you have your flesh, you can buy someone else's art. But you really have this really expansive, wonderful collection here in your house. And, you know, from Fritz Scholder to Jimenez to, is it Harley Brown? I mean, I'm just really impressed by the range. And I wondered what role that Bonnie had played in helping you choose the pieces that you have held on to. I mean, the pieces you've collected. I know what she's done in terms of the ones you kept.
Well, we started, I guess my first year at OCU Night School, Jack Vallée was probably at that time the best watercolors in Oklahoma or in this area, Southwest. And he had gone to OCU, and he had donated a painting to be sold up there. And we couldn't afford it, but I bought it anyway. And we painted it out as a little quarter sheet watercolor. And that was our first painting we got in our collection. And then several years later, we had out in Santa Fe for a show, and we had a chance to buy a couple of Richard Schmidt's work for $150 each.
Wow.
And Bonnie wanted to get them so bad, and I told her, we just can't afford them. And then, so after that, and after making mistakes like that, I decided, you take care of the money. You know what we have, you know what we can afford. If you want it, you buy it. We still collect. We bought several this year. I don't know where we're going to put them, you know. About every year we give about 30 paintings to our kids and grandkids and great-grandkids.
Of your work?
Things we've collected.
Various, I see.
And then we'll start again, you know.
Right.
And but we enjoy collecting, and we don't trade. I don't trade out. I trade one for one piece, and I got such a short end of the deal as a sculptor. And I told him what I wanted, and he said, okay. It wasn't typical what he does. So he delivered it, and I looked at it, and I said, this is terrible. He said, well, that's what you wanted. I said, well, I took it. I put it in the backyard. It stayed out there for probably 15 years.
Oh, my goodness.
It had. And then he started, then we got to be a little closer friends later. And I said, you know what? I said, I've got this sculpture out in my backyard. I'd like to trade you for another piece. That he had already done it, that for that piece there.
Yes.
And so we traded again.
that's funny. But in your career, you only actually traded one of your paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've always purchased.
Now, if you trade, you know, say, I like that and I'll give you this for that,
right.
Fine.
Right.
But he said, let me do this piece of sculpture for you.
I see.
And,
Well, you know, looking at, are you still putting out 365 paintings a year?
Or I'm doing 300 plus now.
Wow. So you're down just a little. That's still a tremendous amount of work.
I was in the hospital last 2 weeks ago, I guess. I spent, went in on Sunday, got out Wednesday. And in that, I did, I think, about 10 nice sketches and sketch paintings and sketchbook then.
While you were in the hospital.
Yeah, while I was in the hospital. And wow. Since then, I haven't been able to really paint, I've sat and done a lot of good sketchbook work.
That's real commitment.
But I've probably turned out, you know, 25 pieces like that, that are frameable, but...
Right. Well, looking back over your career, what do you think has been, I guess, one of the highlights that comes to mind?
What?
One of the highlights.
Well, getting a painting accepted in the Vatican. It went in 1975, and it's in their permanent collection. Two different presidents, Bush and Ford both, they have my work. Got to meet both of them.
This is Bush Sr.? Is this?
A Bush Sr., yes. Uh-huh. And him and Barbara. And then Gerald and Betty. Their painting, it's in their library collection in Ann Arbor, Michigan now. And Bush's, he told me they're going to keep it in their collection until they tire of it. Then you go to their library collection. So I felt honored that way. Different times, different things. Lonnie Anderson, Burt Reynolds, they bought it one time.
Wow, fun. Was this at a show in California, or?
Yes, Got a chance to be acquainted with several important people, movie-type people, different times, and Jonathan Winters, he was the first, I guess, star that bought one of my paintings. And so I've been... Every year, there's, you know, it doesn't take much to excite me.
And, well, that's pretty exciting stuff.
Getting interviewed by, you know, by you, Seth, that's another highlight in my life.
Well, is there...
The Chronicles of OSU.
Yes. Is there anything that you would like to add that we maybe haven't talked about or... Something that you think it's important to mention?
Not really. It's just art has been my passion all my life. You know, I love it. I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't paint. I can be feeling bad, terrible. I'd go up to our studio and I'd sit down or stand up in front of a canvas and I forget my pains. And I can stand up there for hours then. Bonnie have to come get me. Get out here and get your medicine and rest, you know. But it's been a great thing for me. I've enjoyed every bit of it. And I enjoy matting my mat mine, I frame mine, you know, I do it all. And I enjoy everything about it.
Well,
from etchings, I have my own etching press. I can go out, I can pull etchings, I can do monotypes, collagraphs, whatever. During my career, the starting oils and watercolor, I can still do those if I want to. And so I feel like I'm a well-satisfied person. Good wife, good family, good kids. And so I've been very fortunate. Fortunate to make my living doing art, doing what I want to do first, you know. And got to travel, meet a lot of people. And like I said, I still do 300 plus paintings. I'm a workaholic. I work for, you know, so many years. I've spent 20 hours easily every day, you know. And I've slowed down now. I usually go up, I work in the morning till noon, and then we go out and eat lunch. We eat out 365 days a year.
Wow.
Unless it's Thanksgiving, we might eat in. But,
did you start that when you were so busy, like on the road?
Yeah. I'd work up till noon, we'd go to UPS, mail paintings, go pick up art supplies, eat, come back home, start working again, you know.
That's great.
And, but it's been great. We've met, you know, so many good artists and good friends and collectors, and it's just been a wonderful life, really. My wife, she gave up. She didn't go to college. She became a wife and taking care of me.
Right, you married after high school, I guess.
And then she was 16 when we got married. I was 18.
Well, we just all feel very fortunate, too, that you chose what you did. Really, I really love your work.
Thank you, Julie.
So thank you for your time, Bert.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.